UN Special Rapporteur visiting Iran denounces U.S. sanctions against Tehran as unjustified, calling on Washington to immediately remove them. Hamas warns Israel against any attempt to assassinate the Palestinian resistance leaders, saying that such a move will lead to an all-out regional conflict. Also in the headlines, Turkey accuses Sweden and Finland of harboring terrorist organizations, threatening to block their bids for NATO membership. Thanks for joining us. The UN Special Rapporteur has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane, urging Washington to immediately remove them. Alina Dohan, in a press briefing during her visit to Tehran, highlighted the negative impact of unilateral coercive U.S. measures. Dohan said the sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. The UN official added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's efforts to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions. The political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that any attempt by Israel to assassinate resistance leaders would lead to an all-out conflict in the region. Ismail Haniyeh issued a warning in letters sent to the leaders of many regional countries. According to his media advisor, Haniyeh urged the countries to warn the Israeli regime and its leaders against returning to its assassination policy. He stressed that the regime would pay an unexpected price if it goes ahead with its plan. That after Israeli media recently cited senior military sources as saying that the assassination of top Hamas officials is still an option. The report said that Hamas leader in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar, and Mohammed Deif, the commander of the group's military wing, Qassam Brigades, are the obvious targets. Let's discuss this with our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, who joins us from Gaza City. Ashraf Shannon, Israel is known to have assassinated resistance group leaders in the past. Maybe you can give us a brief touchback on that, and also why now they are coming out making these threats, especially to top Hamas leaders.
Well, Kaveh, in the recent weeks, there have been threats against Hamas leaders and resistance factions leaders, mainly within the Israeli media and from Israeli members of the Knesset or parliament. But yesterday, during a press conference by the Israeli military, they said that assassination against Palestinian resistance faction leaders is still an option. Hamas's political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh said that he warned the Israeli regime against assassinating any of the resistance factions leaders, while senior Hamas official Mahmoud Zahar said that the Palestinian resistance groups have made a deterrence in recent years against the Israeli regime, possibly preventing them from carrying such assassinations. In recent weeks, we had Hamas's military wing, the Azim Qassam Brigades, issuing a strong threat against Israel, saying that if, in case they assassinate any member of the Palestinian resistance factions, commanders or leaders, rockets from the Gaza Strip will rain on Israeli city. Some analysts believe that the reason for such threat is that the so-called coalition government within the Israeli regime is fragile, and possibly the Israeli prime minister trying to garner support from other members of his government and the Israeli Knesset by making threats against Palestinian resistance factions, especially that we saw over the last few weeks an increase in resistance operations within the Israeli regime. The Israeli regime trying to scapegoat the resistance factions by blaming them for carrying such attacks. They mainly blame Hamas's leader in Gaza, Yahya al-Sinwar, who during the last days of the holy month of Ramadan called on all Palestinians within occupied historical land of Palestine to use all forms of resistance against the Israeli forces, whether it's knives or axes or anything that they have available against Israeli soldiers and police.
You rightly said that this perhaps comes at a time when Israel is feeling, I guess, somewhat weak in terms of its overall security apparatus, given the fact that we've seen some resistance operations, and of course the tense situation that is in the occupied territories. Does all of this point to the fact that they're making these types of, or issuing these types of somewhat bold statements because they are trying not to get engaged in a war with the Gaza resistance factions, given the fact that they're acutely aware that they're going to be rained on with the resistance rockets?
I think the Israeli government itself is afraid of launching a war against the Gaza Strip, especially the last year around this time. The resistance factions, mainly Hamas's military wing, started the war against the Israeli regime when they were attacking Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Al-Quds, and at that time they launched rockets towards the Israeli regime within 1 hour after making a threat. So I think the Israeli government is afraid of launching a war, but at the same time they want the Israeli public to think that they are willing to wage a war. So the only thing they did is carry out maneuvers for a 30-day period.
Great. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Avshar Shannon, our correspondent from Gaza City. Many thanks. Moving on, Finland and Sweden formally submit their request to join the NATO alliance, a move that is likely to draw a response from Russia. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has welcomed the bids for membership, describing it as a historic moment. The decisions triggered by Russia's military operation in Ukraine have earlier drawn Moscow's reaction. Russia has warned Finland that the decision would seriously damage bilateral ties and security in northern Europe. Moscow has also warned of deployment of nuclear weapons and hypersonic missiles. Meanwhile, the bids for membership in the U.S.-led alliance are drawing Turkey's opposition, with Ankara threatening to block their requests. The Turkish president has accused both countries of harboring terrorist organizations. While the conflict in Ukraine continues, a correspondent to Donetsk traveled to the Petrovsky district near the front line to investigate the shelling of Donbas civilians by the Ukrainian army.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school. Two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbas separatists. The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done. A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them.
Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many, like Yulia, prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery.
While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. Indeed, as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Well, a correspondent in Ukraine has also interviewed residents in Kharkiv. That's a city under the Russian military siege for over 2 months now. Let's take a listen.
We are residents of Kharkiv and live on its outskirts. The Russian forces, accompanied by tanks, entered the city from the other side. They continue their operations throughout the night, firing tank and artillery shells non-stop, targeting almost everything. We and everyone else are staying in bunkers. We thought it would finish in a day or two, but shelling continued uninterrupted. We can't leave our homes, and if we have to go out, we simply crawl. The Russian troops, however, do not harm civilians, but our phones, electricity, and the internet are all cut off. Those who are able and courageous try to shift their children to safety out of the town.
Russia has accused Ukraine of being unwilling to continue peace talks to end hostilities as the war between the two grinds into its third month with no end in sight to the fighting. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that peace talks are not moving forward due to a lack of will from Ukrainian negotiators. Russia's top negotiator has also said that he has yet to receive a response to a draft agreement that he sent to Ukraine in mid-April. This as Kiev has already announced the suspension of negotiations, blaming Moscow for not making any compromises. The two sides have held several rounds of talks since February, but all ended without breakthroughs. There's no way of knowing how badly the conflict in Ukraine might damage the European Union's economy, experts tell an international conference in Brussels. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Rising electricity, gas, oil, petrol, and food prices are drastically pushing the standard of living down for millions of citizens across the 27-nation EU. The European Commission's flagship annual conference focusing on the economy has been told things could get much worse.
In addition to the fact that the war could escalate, sanctions and counter-sanctions could create further problems, there is also the fact that in China, growth is slowing.
The Brussels Economic Forum 2022 also heard that financial pressures, mainly resulting from the conflict in Ukraine, are disproportionately impacting young adults in precarious jobs.
We're picking up incredible increases and disconcerting increases in anxiety, stress, depression, burnouts.
Some analysts suggest untold misery is being piled on citizens because the West purposely ignored Russia's legitimate security concerns. We have been seeking opinions on the current economic pressures.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings will go down.
It will go until the point where people understand, okay, this is the peak, we cannot do anymore, and then let's see what's happened. I don't know.
Not only the energy, but the prices of food, the prices of transport. So everything is much more higher.
Driving the EU's foreign policy, critics say Washington has put the bloc in an unwinnable situation. There was no mention of that by key speakers at the Brussels conference.
Thanks to our unity, we have seen that swift and sweeping sanctions can have enormous force.
Enormous force for who? Russia's currency, the ruble, is doing very well, and the Federation is benefiting from rising energy prices. Experts warn of catastrophe if the Kremlin decides to cut off its gas supplies to the EU. As one contributor at the Brussels Economic Forum put it, there is no economy without energy. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
Moscow expels dozens of diplomats from France, Spain, and Italy, retaliation for a similar decision taken by the trio against Russia over its war in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry says 34 French diplomatic staffs have been declared persona non grata and have 2 weeks to leave the country. The ministry has also expelled 27 Spanish diplomats while announcing plans to 24 Italian staffers. The Italian Prime Minister has condemned the decision as a hostile act. Mario Draghi says diplomatic channels must not be interrupted. Last month, France, Spain, and Italy announced the expulsion of scores of Russian diplomats as part of a joint European action over the offensive in Ukraine. Russia has taken tit-for-tat measures against several Western countries since the launch of the war, which Moscow says is aimed at denazifying Ukraine. Activists in Latin American countries hold events to mark the 74th anniversary of Palestine's Nakba Day, or the Day of Catastrophe. People in Peru, Panama, Chile, and Argentina held rallies and marches in solidarity with the people of Palestine. The Venezuelan capital Caracas paid tribute to slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abakle by projecting her photo on the building of the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development. The Al Jazeera reporter was fatally shot by Israeli troops last week while covering a raid on the Palestinian city of Jenin. Abakle's death touched off international condemnation of the Tel Aviv regime's violence. That does it for this edition of World News.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Republican politicians, including some of the party's top leaders, openly espouse versions of a white supremacist conspiracy theory, holding that an orchestrated effort is underway to displace white Americans. A recently published opinion poll found that almost half of Republicans believe that immigrants are being brought to the United States as part of such an effort. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, "The Buffalo Shooting Was Not a Random Act of Violence." the US, Republican politicians, including some of the party's top leaders, openly espouse versions of a white supremacist conspiracy theory, holding that an orchestrated effort is underway to displace white Americans. A recently published opinion poll found that almost half of Republicans believe that immigrants are being brought to the United States as part of such an effort. On Saturday, 14th of May, a gunman who said he was motivated by a version of this so-called replacement theory killed 10 people at a Buffalo, New York grocery store, according to officials. The suspect, identified as Peyton S. Gendron, wrote in an online diatribe that he sought to kill black people because he wanted to prevent white people from losing their rightful control of the country. Peyton Gendron described himself as part of a movement. He said that he was inspired by similar attacks on other minority communities and that he hoped others would follow his example. The suspects in several mass killings in recent years, including the 2015 murder of 9 black worshippers at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, the 2018 murder of 11 Jewish worshippers at a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the 2019 murder of 51 Muslim worshippers at a pair of mosques in New Zealand, and the 2019 murder of 23 people, many of them Latinos, in El Paso, Texas, also propounded versions of this racist worldview. American life is punctuated by mass shooting incidents that are routinely described as idiosyncratic. But these attacks are not random acts of violence. They are part of a long American history of political violence perpetrated by white supremacists against black people and other minority groups. Politicians who have employed some of the vocabulary of replacement theory generally do not make explicit calls for violence. The office of one of those politicians, Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, said in a statement that the Buffalo attack was an act of evil and that she has never advocated for any racist position. But the matter is not so simple. Replacement theory is an attack on democracy. It privileges the purported interests of some Americans over those of others, asserting, in effect, that the will of the people means the will of white people. It rekindles fears and resentments among white Americans that cynical practitioners of American politics have stoked throughout the nation's history. It also provides a disturbing rationalization for people inclined to resort to violence when the political process does not deliver what they want or protect what they see as their place in society. The Fox News Channel host, Tucker Carlson, a leading purveyor of replacement theory rhetoric, has promoted the idea that elites are seeking to replace white Americans on more than 400 episodes of his program on Fox News Channel, according to an analysis by the New York Times. Now, I know that the left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate. The voters now casting ballots with new people, more obedient voters from the third world, Tucker Carlson said on an episode in April of 2021. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Representative Matt Gaetz, a Florida Republican, later tweeted that Tucker Carlson is correct about replacement theory as he explains what is happening in America. In September, Elise Stefanik's re-election campaign paid for a Facebook advertisement that combined imagery of immigrants with the accusation that radical Democrats are planning their most aggressive move yet, a permanent election insurrection. Ali Stefanik's advertisement continued. Their plan to grant amnesty to 11 million illegal immigrants will overthrow our current electorate and create a permanent liberal majority in Washington. Right-wing rhetoricians in the United States portray undocumented immigrants as the primary threat. This sanitizes replacement theory for mainstream consumption without diluting its logic. The same argument is easily applied to other minority groups in the United States. The French author Renaud Camus coined the term the Great Replacement in a 2011 book to describe what he saw as a conscious effort by French elite to open the country's doors for Muslim immigrants to replace the ethnically French population and French culture. The template has been adapted for use by extremists around the world. Mr. Gendron wrote that he blamed Jews for orchestrating the replacement of white Americans. He copied large portions of his manifesto from the document posted to justify the New Zealand killings, in some cases, inserting the name of Jewish businessman George Soros in place of the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel's name. The manifesto posted by the El Paso shooting suspect, which Mr. Gendron also referenced, spoke of the Hispanic invasion of Texas. The common thread, the ineluctable core of replacement theory, is that some people are white and some people are not, and that the people who are white are threatened by those who are not. It must also be emphasized that the United States makes it easy for domestic terrorists to kill. The police said that the Buffalo assailant used a Bushmaster XM-15 rifle that he had purchased legally at a gun shop near his hometown. As a practical matter, almost anyone can buy guns that are designed to kill a lot of people quickly. The only real line of defense is the judgment of the people who sell guns. He didn't stand out, because if he did, I would have never sold him the gun, Robert Donald, the store's owner, told the New York Times. The focus on the gunman's motive should not obscure the fact that the most important step the government can take to impede similar attacks is to limit the availability of guns in the United States. The health of American democracy also requires the constructive use of free speech, especially by the nation's political leaders. There are always demagogues whose stock in trade is the demonization of immigrants and other minority groups. And American society has long allowed those on the fringes to air their views. The question in any era is whether such views are voiced or echoed by those in positions of responsibility. It is telling that House Republicans last year installed Ali Stefanik in leadership to replace Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, who remains among the most forthright critics of the Republican Party's illiberal turn. Liz Cheney tweeted on Monday, "The House GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. History has taught us that what begins with words ends in far worse. GOP leaders must renounce and reject these views and those who hold them." And Liz Cheney is certainly right.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. it's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Everything that God has blessed us with in terms of guidance, which is the greatest blessing He has given us, He has given us through Muhammad and Awl Muhammad, salawatullah wa salamu alayhim ajma'in. And He has said, we're using this, as we said, this is one of the references. God says, anishkur li wa li walidayk, shukr, be thankful, appreciate me and your parents. The Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, said to his nation, أنا وعلي أبوا هذه الأمة. I and Ali are the parents of this ummah, are the fathers of this ummah. That expresses that relationship. If you look at it, life as we know it, true life, the life of iman, the life of prosperity, enjoying all aspects of human life, and not limiting it to the lower levels and the lower desires of the human nature. Enjoying full prosperity in the full human sense, not a partial sense, especially not the lower portion. That life God gives us when a child is born and says, حَمَلَتْهُ أُمُّهُ وَهْنًا عَلَى وَهْنٍ وَفِصَالُهُ فِي عَامَيْنِ, 2 years plus the time that the child spent in the womb. Well, who gave life and who created that child? Was it the mother? Was it the father? No, Allah. إِنَّا خَلَقْنَاكُم مِّن ذَكَرٍ وَأُنثَى. God created. But God says, I created through your parents. Now, especially in the more difficult part of the process of creating you, the part that involves a human being, and the difficulty is on the human being, not on Allah. The human being that goes through that process and is part of that process, and God made her the main part of that process in many ways, is your mother. But God made her that. He says, be thankful. This life that we have, if we have it, and inshallah, to a certain degree we do, but we need to work on that. What we have received from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who did He give it to us through? The Holy Prophet and his daughter and brother and son-in-law, Amir al-Mu'mineen, and grandchildren and great-grandchildren onwards, the 14 Ma'sumeen. The pain of delivering this life to us was much more than what a mother goes through to deliver a living child, to deliver us with life, material life, physical life in this world. Mother, it's a 2 years and some months in the womb. Difficult, very painful. What the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi went through, Amir al-Mu'mineen and Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayhima went through, Imam al-Mujtaba went through, Imam al-Husayn went through, Ali ibn al-Husayn, Imam Zain al-Abidin, Imam al-Baqir, Imam al-Sadiq, Imam al-Kadhim, Imam al-Ridha, Imam al-Jawad, Imam al-Hadi, 14 ma'sumeen, over 13 of them over the course of 60-70 years, and then the last of those imams is still going through to present this to all of mankind and to deliver this life. The pain that they have and are going through is more than what a mother goes through. And as we said, that hadith says, "Ana wa Ali abawa hadhihi al-ummah." The fathers of this ummah are me and Ali. The Quran says, "Anishkur li wa li walidayk." It's a command. The other verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, قُلْ لَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عليه أجرا إلا المودة في القربة. It's considered an ajr, a reward for him presenting the message to, for the people to be good and loving towards those who are close to him. المودة في القربة. Who are the قربة of the Prophet? The ones who were close to him, the ones who were really close to him, not just physically. They are the Ahlul Bayt. That's the other way that mentions it. This verse, أَنِشْكُرْ لِي وَلِوَالِدَيْكَ. We are supposed to appreciate the human beings that are involved in us receiving a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And they are willingly part of that and wanting to deliver that. Those people need to be, God says, appreciate that. أَنِشْكُرْ لِي وَلِوَالِدَيْكَ. The people that have been involved in the greatest blessing that has been given to us, all of us and any of us, no matter where we are, what ethnic background, what nationality, what locality, what time, what era, the greatest guidance, the greatest blessing is the blessing of guidance. Who was involved with that? The Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. We're supposed to do shukr of that. Shukr. Anishkur li wa li walidayk. What is the shukr? What's the shukr of and being thankful and appreciative towards the Prophet and his household? How is that? Well, that one verse mentions it in the form of al-mawaddata fil qurba. Those who are close to him, which are his daughter, son-in-law, grandchildren, those are the ones who during his lifetime, his physical lifetime, he saw them, the rest of them are the rest of the imams. They are the qurba that the Quran is referring to. Because as we said, it's not physical closeness. The closest people to the Prophet are the Ahlul Bayt. Nobody is even close to the Ahlul Bayt in terms of their closeness to the Holy Prophet. They are so close that in hadith it says, they are kulluhum nurun wahid. The Quran, anfusana wa anfusakum, in regards to Ali ibn Abi Talib and the Prophet, Ali ibn Abi Talib being the nafs of the Prophet, the self, ourselves. Who is ourselves with the Prophet? It's Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayhi. What is appreciation? Perhaps if we were to think about this on our own and not ask God, how do you want us to appreciate them? And of course, if we appreciate them as these verses mentioned and the verses regarding that reward for the prophethood of the Prophet, the ajr that was mentioned, which is al-mawaddata fil qurba, that ajr, which is al-mawadda, showing love towards the Ahlul Bayt, وَمَا سَأَلْتُكُم مِّنْ أَجْرٍ فَهُوَ لَكُمْ. It's for you. The benefit of that goes to you. That appreciation will help us. But what is that appreciation? How do we appreciate? If we were to think of that on our own, and try to understand what our role is or what we need to do to appreciate the work of the Ahlul Bayt, perhaps we wouldn't be able to come to this, and many people haven't.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Ghafur Shakur Wadud Qayyim
Majid.
محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمني صل عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson lacks the authority to fix the problems that his protocol has created in Northern Ireland. Meanwhile, the people of Northern Ireland are suffering. We now present you an article written by Simon Jenkins. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian and is titled Boris Johnson created this Brexit mess in Northern Ireland, and he should own it. Two of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's most reckless chickens are coming home to roost. To get hard Brexit into law and topple his predecessor, Theresa May, he told Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party, DUP, that it would allow no border in the Irish Sea. He promptly allowed one and signed a protocol to the Brexit deal to that effect. An enraged DUP is duly refusing to let the new Northern Irish executive take office until that border goes. Boris Johnson is now threatening to unilaterally renege on the protocol, in turn enraging the European Union by flagrantly breaching the withdrawal deal. Precisely this trap was built into hard Brexit from day one. Everyone knew it. It was classic Boris Johnson. He lied his way out of each scrape, sacking or ennobling colleagues according to taste. The absence of a new executive in Belfast leaves open the prospect of direct rule from London. If Boris Johnson fails to dismantle the EU-ordained border controls at Belfast docks, the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, will stall power sharing. If he gives in and allows the world's goods to flow freely into the Irish Republic, the European Union has threatened to retaliate in an all-out trade war. The question is, what new constructive ambiguity, a euphemism for fudge, Boris Johnson can conceivably fashion to get him out of this mess? Amid all the shouting and screaming of Brexit, quiet voices were warning, don't forget Northern Ireland. The Brexiters dismissed it as a historical trifle. Since the United Kingdom would have tariff-free trade with the European Union, the Irish border would be frictionless, no problem. Of all the deceits of hard Brexit, none was more blatant than the word frictionless. Boris Johnson in effect ceded authority over the 40% of Britain's trade, that is, with the European Union, under the pretense that he was taking back control. But it takes two to trade. 100-page forms and hours-long queues at Dover have been the result, with similar friction at Belfast border. The Marks and Spencers chairman, Archie Norman, protested recently that a staggering 700 pages of forms is required to get two trucks across the Irish Sea from England, requiring 8 hours of work by 20 staff. The reality is that any border is a border, offering any number of impediments to trade. The European Union was furious at hard Brexit. What on earth made Boris Johnson think it would make life easier? The Prime Minister's first decision must be to call the bluff of the Democratic Unionist Party's intransigent leader, Geoffrey Donaldson. Stony-faced unionists have been the bane of British Prime Ministers back to Lloyd George. In 1921, the territory was gerrymandered to deliver a perpetual unionist majority, and the resulting one-party rule has caused Britain little but trouble. At this month's local elections, that historic act of gerrymandering failed. An exhausted electorate in Northern Ireland split the unionist vote three ways. Sinn Féin has emerged in pole position. It could one day lead Northern Ireland, with care, towards eventual reunion with the South. Geoffrey Donaldson faces an existential threat and has nothing to lose. The Good Friday Agreement of 1998 achieved peace by embedding power sharing between the nationalist and unionist constituencies. With each side having a veto, it has constantly broken down and cannot survive formally without the leading unionist bloc, the DUP, in play. At the same time, Northern Ireland's government is reportedly a shambles. In particular, its health service is delivering some of the worst outcomes of any part of the United Kingdom. Just recently, it was reported that the number of people waiting for more than 12 hours in accidents and emergencies had doubled in a year. Somehow, the logjam must be cleared. Boris Johnson has to demand that DUP's leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, must return to Stormont or that Northern Ireland must be ruled without him. Until power sharing returns, with First Minister designate Michelle O'Neill in post, London must find a mechanism for re-establishing the executive, with a role for Michelle O'Neill. This might involve some sort of ghost executive until the formal aegis in the Northern Ireland secretary. The reality is that democracy in Northern Ireland is starting to change, and in a welcome and more open direction. London has ruled its Irish territory abominably for over a century. It owes it help towards a new dawn. The short-term question remains whether Boris Johnson can say anything to the Unionists sufficient to entice them back. For most in Northern Ireland, the border is not the chief political issue. It has been replaced by the cost of living crisis and the state of the health service. By the same token, it is clearly worth attempting yet again to plead with Brussels' better nature to find some partial compromise on the border question. The present controls are indefensible. Hard Brexit was a mistake, a crude and casual gesture by Boris Johnson to prop up his leadership bid. He showed no sign of knowing what hard might entail. But then, there were few Remainers ready to support soft Brexit as a halfway house. As it is, Brussels negotiators have clearly been instructed to play tough, subjecting British trade to a nightmare of barriers and bureaucracy. These are palpably beyond anything needed to protect standards, health and safety. At the same time, there is no reason for Britain not to accede to standards that it has shared with the rest of the continent for half a century. The proposals reputedly offered by the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss to ease the Belfast border are reasonable but inoperable, in the absence of the European Union's agreement. They embrace licensed, trusted traders and red and green lanes for vehicles intended to go on to Ireland and those remaining in Northern Ireland. A modicum of supervision should be able to protect the European Union from global trade contamination. there is no need to chase trawlers across the high seas or follow British number plates through the lanes of Louth and Donegal. Surely there is compromise somewhere here. Europe has enough on its hands without the distraction of a childish trade war with Britain. Yes, Britain is to blame. It chose to leave the European Union, but the European Union should respect that. In addition, Boris Johnson personally interpreted Brexit as leaving Europe's economic trade area, for which he had no mandate. That decision is costing Britain dearly, and one day will have to be corrected. For the moment, Prime Minister owes it to Northern Ireland to free it from the mess into which hard Brexit has condemned it. In doing so, he would yet set it on the road to political reconstruction. That, at least, would be a silver lining on the Brexit cloud.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic.
I wish to raise some concluding points. Dear brothers, dear sisters, the opportunity of having a responsibility is very fleeting, and it will soon come to an end. Therefore, you must appreciate the value of this opportunity. You must use every hour of it. The second word of advice is that you should not work for the purpose of a show. You should not think of working for the sake of being seen by the people who have elected you or the people who watch you on television. This will spoil the blessedness of your work If you think of doing something to make the people like you, and you do not think of the significance of the task and of divine satisfaction, the blessedness of your work will be gone, and on many occasions you will not achieve any result either. The third issue is the conflict of interest. I see that the term conflict of interest is frequently used in the majlis, in the parliament. The conflict of interest does not only exist in the economy. These conflicts exist in other areas as well. If we have some interest in the people's attention to us, and if another interest is the public interest of the country, here too there is a conflict of interest. Which one do you prioritize? If we prioritize our reputation and the people's attention to us over the interests of the country, this is an example of conflict of interest. We must take God into account. This is another issue.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Majlis, the parliament, and the administration have specific duties on the basis of the law. In another meeting, I mentioned that these lines must be observed. Things must develop in a way that the administration has its own responsibilities for which it must be answerable. The Majlis should be answerable too, so that one can judge its performance. If things get mixed up, it will become difficult to judge. Dear God, by the blessedness of Muhammad and his household, make our intentions pure. Make what we said, what we did, and what we will say and do serve you and your cause. Dear God, make our hearts brim over with the purity of our actions on your path. Dear God, by the blessedness of Muhammad and his household, associate our magnanimous Imam who opened this path to the nation and who brought us to this arena and this path with your prophets and saints. Make his immaculate soul satisfied with us. Make the pure souls of our dear martyrs satisfied with us. Bestow your reward, patience, blessings, and mercy on their families. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.